and welcome to Religion in the News. This is Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be featuring articles from Religion News Service, from the Harvard Business Review, from the Associated Press, and more. This broadcast is intended for people who are blind and print impaired, and podcast copies of this and other Religion in the News broadcasts are available on our website at ncreadingservice.org. We'll begin this week's edition of Religion in the News with an article from December 7th published on Religion News Service, and this is entitled, Black Pastor Leads His White North Carolina Church Toward a Fuller Reckoning on Race. The subheadline, in one of the most conservative cities in North Carolina, a United Methodist pastor gingerly approaches racial issues without alienating his flock. This is by Yonat Shimron of Religion News Service, Dateline Salisbury, North Carolina. The Sunday morning service at Providence United Methodist Church last month began with a few praise songs, as usual, then an opening prayer. But before launching into his sermon, the Reverend Aldana Allen offered a personal testimony. I want to begin by glorifying and thanking God once again for my life, my health, and my strength, Allen told his congregants, who listened to the sermon from their cars as part of the new coronavirus routine. He then proceeded to relate a terrifying incident that happened to him the Sunday before. On his way home from church, he stopped for gas. As he was driving away, he noticed he was being followed, Allen said. He took an alternate route just to make sure, but the person continued to follow him. As Allen finally pulled into his driveway in a suburb of Charlotte, so did his pursuer, who began revving his car, lunging forward and pulling back. The standoff in the middle of Allen's driveway continued for several minutes. Eventually, the pursuer drove off. It was an important reminder, he said, of humankind's fallenness. He then delivered his sermon. Allen, who has led the small rural church for the past 6 years, is black. His members are overwhelmingly white. This North Carolina church, about 40 miles northeast of Charlotte and several miles outside historic downtown Salisbury, is a microcosm of the old rural South. The country roads leading to the 182-year-old church are dotted with Trump 2020 signs. Salisbury is the county seat of Rowan County, which voted for Trump over Biden by a 2-to-1 margin, 67-31%. The city is the birthplace of Bob Jones, the late Grand Dragon of the North Carolina Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. Some homes here still fly the Confederate flag, and until this summer, a prominent bronze statue of an angel carrying a Confederate soldier stood on a pedestal right outside St. John's Lutheran Church downtown. Yet at Providence United Methodist, race, one of the defining issues of 2020, is being negotiated in new ways. Allen, age 48, doesn't press the issue most Sundays. A Southerner, too, he walks a fine line, not wanting to alienate his congregants or risk a backlash. He did not tell his congregants that his pursuer that Sunday night was white, though he did tell the police who were investigating the incident. He did not point fingers. He did not issue a call to action. But many congregants said they nonetheless understood. Hearing of his most recent experience tells us it's still out there and it exists, said the church's youth leader, Marcy Petty, referring to racial intimidation. It needs to stop. Allen is a Mississippi native who grew up in Tennessee and has spent most of his career working in white churches. He has won the support of his congregants in part by keeping the conversation comfortable and closely relating his experience to Christian themes. Along the way, he's subtly raised his flock's awareness of how racism and racial discrimination continue to pose significant problems for African Americans. The 300 or so congregants at Providence United Methodist did not choose Allen. Pastors in the United Methodist Church are appointed by bishops normally for a year at a time. In a commitment to create a multiracial church, United Methodist bishops have been assigning black pastors to predominantly white congregations for about 50 years. In the Western North Carolina Conference, where Allen is based, covering Greensboro and areas west, there are 24 black pastors among the conference's 898 predominantly white churches. Our belief is that when people develop relationships, biases that are part of the racial context begin to diminish, said Paul Leland, bishop of the Western North Carolina Conference. The conference has recently begun a larger conversation on how to be anti-racist. For many churches, it's a process. Most white churches are initially hesitant to accept a black pastor, Leland said. Providence, where Allen was first appointed in 2014, was no exception. There was apprehension when he was announced, acknowledged Neil Hall, the church's lay leader and a lifelong member. It's something we've never experienced. Allen, age 59, said his own apprehension faded a few months after Allen's arrival, when his daughter, who had been in declining health, died. Hall called Allen, who rushed to the hospital where Hall's daughter Amber was ailing, and stayed with the family, comforting them and reading scripture passages into the early hours of the morning. "He was my pastor in a time of need," said Hall. "That bonds you." For Petty, Allen has been a godly role model, not only for the church youth, but for her two boys, aged 14 and 21. Her eldest, John, had drifted away from the church under the church's previous pastor. Allen visited her home and spoke to John about recommitting to Jesus and returning to church, which he did. She's been so impressed with Allen, she has invited friends curious about her black pastor to hear him preach. "He brings people to see both sides and to know that there are changes in the world, and we need to be a part of those changes," Petty said. Allen, who graduated from the Interdenominational Theological Center in Atlanta, said he was shaped by the black liberation theology of James Cone, who saw justice for the poor and the outcast as the very heart of the Christian gospel. Married to a Presbyterian minister, the couple has two boys, Allen said he believes providing genuine care to his congregants will reduce racial prejudice and bias. In a paper for his doctoral program at Hood Theological Seminary, a historically black school located in Salisbury, Allen recently wrote, "The more I can express our existential commonalities and emphasize that God is the solution to the human predicament, the more the artificial barriers will fall." Being a black pastor in a predominantly white church in the age of Trump has been a challenge nonetheless. The president has defended white nationalists, criticized the Black Lives Matter movement, and generally exacerbated America's racial divide. The death of George Floyd, the black Minneapolis man killed in police custody, and the subsequent protests that broke out across the nation moved Allen to once again take a more direct approach. 10 days after Floyd's death, Allen used his Sunday sermon to expound on the New Testament story of the Good Samaritan and to recount a story from his youth. At a 4th of July fireworks display in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, a white man drove by in a truck, flicked a beer bottle cap against Allen's head, and then spat on him. "That is the ugliest experience of racism I've experienced in my life, but it's not the only one," he told his congregants. "I share that story because of all the things that are going on in the news. I want you to know, it's real." He then went on to say that Americans, and Christians in particular, need to raise their awareness and show more empathy. "Yes, all lives matter," he said, but added, "We're asking you to have empathy for this particular subset of all lives. All lives matter may be theologically correct, but what you're actually doing is stifling healthy conversation." Several members said they were moved. "I will tell you personally, I thought everything was taken care of after Obama was president," said David Shields, a church member. "I thought we were in a post-racial society." Aldana drove home the point that there was a lot of work to be done. Not all Providence members appreciated the sermon. A handful felt the church was a place of refuge. They didn't want to be thrust right back into the storm. A 6-week Bible study about race and reconciliation that Allen started soon afterward was poorly attended. Allen said he wasn't sure if people didn't want to engage the subject or were staying away from church because of pandemic fears. "I hate it for him that the race thing came up and you hear people saying that they're tired of hearing about it," said Pam Irvin, a member who chairs the church's mission projects. "It's sad that we couldn't have these conversations." Allen, however, hasn't given up. Before COVID-19, the church had sermon swaps and common meals with the predominantly black church down the road, and he wants that relationship to continue. So far, church members say they've been able to see each other as people first, not Republicans and Democrats, but Allen is thinking of starting a Bible class on the nation's political divides and how people might come together, perhaps around the time of President-elect Biden's inauguration, he said. Church members aren't sure they can find unity on both sides of the political divide, but on racial issues they said their consciences have been pricked. "I don't think that Pastor Allen being here is accidental," said Hall, the church lay leader. "It's God loosening us up. Pastor Allen was something we needed, and God delivered because he knew these times were coming. He's showing part of what that different way looks like." We'll turn next to an article from December 10th, published in the Harvard Business Review. I know that sounds like a strange outlet for an article on a religion program, but bear with me. It's actually very interesting. The title of this article is Creating Space for Religious Diversity at Work. This article is by Ali Aslan Gumasai, Michael Smets, and Tim Morris. The summary of this article is listed, "Accommodating highly diverse religious beliefs and practices within an organization is challenging but possible." The authors describe the efforts of KT Bank, a firm whose leaders include Muslims, members of other faiths, and people without strong religious convictions, to accommodate and support all beliefs. Two methods stand out. The bank cultivated flexible messaging around their purpose that allowed different groups to interpret those communications in ways that were most meaningful to them. And it provided separate physical spaces and schedule flexibility for employees to be able to practice their faith while at work, but away from their colleagues. We tend to think of business as a secular activity and workplaces as inappropriate settings for conversations about religious faith or observance. However, given the growing popularity of bringing one's whole self to work, the trend toward practices such as yoga and mindfulness, and the fact that more than 80% of the world claims some sort of religious affiliation, leaders are increasingly concerned about how best to handle expressions of faith by their employees. For many religious people, their faith is associated with deeply held values that inform their actions and behaviors at work, as well as in their personal lives. In workplaces where employees feel comfortable talking about their religious beliefs, everyone can gain a richer understanding of their colleagues' personal motivations and of the varied values at play in their organizations. However, there are complications that come with this openness. Once the range of beliefs of a diverse workforce become more public, employees may disagree with each other about them. Expressions of belief may also conflict with the requirements of the business, forcing employers to walk a fine line between non-discrimination on religious grounds, service to the customer, and fair treatment of all employees. These concerns are compounded in organizations that are explicitly religious, such as the Salvation Army, and in others whose founders' religious principles inform the company's values and practices, such as Chick-fil-A. While some employees share the beliefs at the heart of these organizations, those that do not can feel excluded or discriminated against. At either type of organization, certain religious beliefs may dictate that employees dress a certain way or avoid eating certain foods, working on holy days, or serving certain types of customers. Pitting these tenets against the demands of business creates tension in the organization, often with negative ramifications. Conflicts over religious dress have resulted in lawsuits, causing people to leave or be fired, damaging the organization's reputation and making it more difficult to attract or retain staff and customers. At a personal level, people can break under the strain of the conflict. Delivering products or engaging in practices they don't believe in makes them lose confidence in the organization and can become demotivated or quit altogether. But we believe that actively accommodating highly diverse beliefs and practices within an organization is possible. Specifically, we have seen that a business's values, customers' values, and employees' religious values can coexist even when on the surface they may seem pitted against each other. To explore what this might look like, we conducted a 24-month ethnographic study of the opening of KT Bank, the first Islamic bank in Germany. The incompatibility of Islamic teaching with much of conventional Western banking practice makes the potential conflicts in this case particularly intense. Islamic banking explicitly bans the payment of interest and also prohibits the kind of speculation and risk trading that is found in conventional derivatives. The bank's leaders, however, comprising Muslims, members of other faiths, and people without strong religious convictions, adopted a deliberately vague and flexible approach that allows them to accommodate divergent beliefs while maintaining unity. We found that two deliberate practices involving both leaders and employees can help create what we call an elastic hybrid, an organization that can embrace different and potentially even opposing views, allowing all stakeholders to navigate competing commitments in line with their own convictions, and helping the organization to find unity in diversity. We're used to hearing calls for ever more clarity from our leaders, precision about their message, and the ability to align people behind a single powerful vision or purpose. But to create an elastic hybrid organization, leaders must instead cultivate vagueness around how the organization's purpose relates to religious practice. At KT Bank, leaders deliberately obscured the way that the bank balanced its religious and commercial ambitions. The imagery on calendars or products used subtle religious symbols. People versed in Islam would recognize their religious connotation, but others could enjoy them as artistic or cultural artifacts. The most visible instance of this interpretive flexibility was KT Bank's logo. It shows a yellow date tree on a green background. For those unfamiliar with the Islamic faith, this may evoke a sense of environmental or economic sustainability. Muslims, by contrast, would likely recognize green as the color of Islam and associate the date with divine nourishment. Campaign slogans played on double meanings that signaled religious commitments not to speculate or trade in improper goods, but could also be simply construed as a distinctive marketing position. For example, now there is a bank that does not speculate but invests sensibly. The bank's leadership was not aiming to hide anything with this vagueness, but rather to be open to being multiple things to multiple people at the same time. Moving between different physical spaces allows employees to separate out their professional work from their religious observance. Giving them the time to do so also helps alleviate this tension. At KT Bank, we observed how staff found ways to maintain their personal balance between market and religion by use of a prayer room. There, people could temporarily retreat from work and decompress from faith work conflicts and anxieties in whatever way they saw fit. There were no restrictions on how the room could be used or by whom or for which faith. Flexible work times allowed people to accommodate religious practices within the working day. Several members of staff told us that it was the first time they had a designated space for prayer at work and reported feeling deeply content and grateful for the fact that KT Bank had made space for their religious practice. This flexible approach, which includes and recognizes diverse beliefs, allows individual staff to choose their own level of religious intensity and balance it with the demands of the organization in a dynamic way. For example, at times they may choose to subordinate their religious concerns and prioritize what the company needs them to do. At other times, it may be appropriate to question company practices when they seem incompatible with their personal values. A company that is open to doing the latter may benefit from employees' increased willingness to do the former. And as it develops through the interplay between the leaders making space and the employers taking space, the organization is able to bend but not to break. This is a new area of research, and more work is needed to understand successful ways that organizations have handled different kinds of conflicts between value systems and religious practice. But from what we've seen, in a world of volatility, uncertainty, complexity, ambiguity, and paradox, it may be advantageous for an organization to mirror the characteristics demonstrated by KT Bank. A perfectly aligned organization with clarity and focus at every level may not be as adaptable as organizations that make room for and even celebrate ambiguity. We'll turn next to an article from the Associated Press dated December 9th, and this article is entitled "Pandemic Loss Unite Two Rural Missouri Pastors Around Faith." And this is by Luis Andres Henao, David Crary, and Jesse Wardarski of the Associated Press, Dateline Noel, Missouri. 30 miles of rural Missouri separate the two churches, and so much else. One is mostly white, the other hosts services in five languages for a flock that spans the world. Still, every Tuesday the pastors meet midway between their houses of worship, seeking each other's counsel, sharing their joys, and more often, their burdens. Because in these pandemic-racked days, they are sometimes overwhelmed by the crucible of ministering. Whether it be the death of a member, whether it be somebody upset, whether it be losing funding, whether it be just all sorts of different things, or maybe just our own depression, just dealing with being locked up at home, said Pastor Mike Leake at Calvary of Neosho, a Southern Baptist church. One church was staggered by COVID-19 early on. The other has not had as many infections, but has seen congregational life turn upside down. The minister's struggle. Pastor Joshua Manning of the Community Baptist Church in Noel was sickened himself. And still they persevere. While they both want to keep parishioners safe, they're determined to carry on with in-person services as long as members of their congregations are eager to attend. Our mission to profess the gospel doesn't end because the coronavirus is here, Manning said. And so we still have to function. We still have to preach. We still have to meet together. At the end of a recent Sunday, 11 people were immersed in a turquoise baptismal pool behind the altar of Community Baptist, thousands of miles from the islands in the Pacific Ocean where they were born. This was the last of five services for five international congregations, in all about 200 people, who worship at the church in Noel. The town of 1800 in the far southwest corner of Missouri has a large immigrant population, including Pacific Islanders, Mexicans, Sudanese, and refugees from Myanmar. Most arrived here, drawn by the opportunity of a job at the local Tyson Foods chicken processing plant. Many were infected with COVID-19 during the summer when McDonald County, where Noel is located, became a hotspot of the pandemic. Few places were hit as hard by the virus this summer. Though it has just 23,000 residents, in late June only four other Missouri counties and the cities of St. Louis and Kansas City had recorded more cases. So far, there have been 1,715 confirmed cases of COVID-19 and 24 deaths in McDonald County, according to figures released December 7th by the county's health department. At the start of June, McDonald County had fewer than two dozen confirmed cases. By June 23rd, 498 cases had been confirmed. 3 days later, Tyson Foods announced that 371 employees at its chicken processing plant in Noel had tested positive for COVID-19. Tyson said it is implementing a new COVID monitoring strategy, but did not provide an update on confirmed cases up to December, despite multiple requests. Just pretty close to overnight, most of our church body and the town largely had it. At the onset of the pandemic, Manning closed the church for 2 months to follow safety guidelines. When he reopened it in June, he contracted the virus and was forced to shut it down again for a month. His wife Lauren and three children were also sickened, as was Lauren's grandfather, who died in October. And the church's Spanish-language pastor, Roberto Nunez, died in July. A pastor has been driving more than 5 hours back and forth from Nebraska to lead the Spanish service each Sunday. Amid all of this, Manning has pushed ahead. "I have to basically balance two different things," the 41-year-old pastor said. "I have to preach the gospel. The church has to meet together. Businesses have to run. Without the poultry industry running, people don't get paid and people don't eat. You have to have school. You have to have those things. And doing any of those things carries risk. And I know, because I've lost people that's close to me." Manning worked for 2 decades as a Walmart manager before he chose to follow his calling and became pastor of the church in 2018. He had lived near in McDowell County for most of his life, but knew little about Noel. Though the town near the Missouri-Arkansas-Oklahoma border is named for a founding family, many across the world send Christmas cards to the Noel post office so they can be stamped from the Christmas City. Immigrants from Mexico and Central America began to arrive here in the late 90s, drawn by the opportunity to work for Tyson. They were followed by people from Somalia and Sudan, Pacific Islanders, and refugees from Myanmar. Manning said that many had lived in refugee camps in Thailand, and when they first arrived in town, they slept on concrete floors. Now many are homeowners and their kids attend college. "If you want to talk about the American dream on steroids," he said, "this is it." The coronavirus, though, showed the extent of food insecurity in a town where many children rely on free meals at school. Manning started a food pantry at his church's community center. On a recent Saturday, he drove his van around town and picked up 3 young congregants from Myanmar's ethnic Karen minority who were excited to volunteer. He later treated them to pizza and lowered the rim of the basketball court at the community center so they could dunk. The next day, he delivered a sermon at his church that was translated a couple sentences at a time. "We are separate from different tribes," Manning told the congregation, "but we're all part of God's kingdom, this kingdom we call the church." Speaking in his second-floor office after a day of back-to-back services, Manning said the church was still affected by COVID, but the effect isn't largely negative. The pandemic, he said, also brought a revival of faith. He estimated that in the past 3 months, a record 50 people have been baptized in the church. "The spiritual hunger of people is very different than what it was before," he said. "This is an extraordinary revival because people have a passionate interest when times are tough to what is the important stuff in life, and they go back to their faith." Melody Binajal, 27, a Hawaiian of Marshallese parents who moved to Noel this year, sat in one of the front pews, her hair still wet after being baptized. Her father-in-law died after contracting the virus. "It's a struggle," she said, "but it's the perfect time to just give your life to Jesus, because you never know when or what time he's going to arrive and just take everything away from us." A 30-minute drive north from Noel is the town of Neosho, nicknamed the Flower Box City. Its population of 12,000 is far less diverse than Noel's, roughly 85% white, with relatively few immigrants and no meat processing plants. Those differences have not spared Neosho and its 20 churches from heartbreak and disruption as the coronavirus arrived in force in June and continues to take a heavy toll. Back in March, the coronavirus seemed to pose no threat to southwest Missouri as its toll mounted overseas and in a few distant parts of the U.S. But even then, the outbreak caused the first of many disruptions for Calvary of Neosho. Late on March 9th, Leak learned that the Southern Baptist International Mission Board had urged the denomination's churches to cancel any foreign mission trips scheduled over the next 6 weeks. The very next day, Leak and 3 members of his congregation had planned to depart on a mission trip to Mexico. But he heeded the IMB warning and called Ashley Jones, one of the would-be travelers who had been making the arrangements. She scrambled to cancel their flights. The months that followed have been challenging for the congregation, as initial hopes that Neosho was spared gave way to realization that the pandemic was on its doorstep. "We've had a lot of ups and downs," Jones said, "but we have a good core group of people who've been super faithful and know that God is in control. A lot of us have grown in unity through this." Leak held an in-person service the Sunday after the mission was canceled, and then, following state and local restrictions, halted such services for 7 weeks while resorting to online worship. At that time, with few COVID-19 cases in the area, some residents were furious at city officials who ordered restrictions. On May 10th, as the restrictions on indoor gatherings eased, Leak resumed services at the church, but only after sending his congregation a detailed notice outlining new safety measures. Worshippers were asked to maintain 6 feet of social distance and no longer gather in prayer circles. The offering plate was no longer passed through the congregation. Instead, donation baskets were placed at exits. When the church reopened, drawing a congregation about half the normal size, Neosho's Newton County had recorded only 19 cases. But soon, like much of the Midwest, the county of 58,000 people was hit by a surge. By July 1st, there had been 427 cases, and by late November, about 3,000. The county's COVID-19 death toll stood at 1 in early June. It's now approaching 40. Like other Neosho pastors, Leak has wrestled with whether Calvary should again halt in-person services. Instead, he's encouraging congregation members to attend if they and their families are healthy, and stay away if they're sick or at risk. As of late November, no one in the congregation had died of COVID-19, Leak said, but several contracted the disease or had friends or relatives who died. Before the outbreak, Sunday's attendance was averaging around 200. Only 98 people attended on May 10th, Leak said, but recently attendance has been around 120 to 150. Revenue from weekly offerings has ranged from a below-average $3,000 one Sunday to an above-average $9,000 the next week. Throughout the pandemic, Leak has encouraged Calvary worshipers to wear masks at services, but has not mandated it. Scott Tucker, who works at a local golf course, is in the majority that does not. "I'm not going to live in fear," he said. "Whatever happens here on this earth isn't going to affect my eternity. If I die from COVID, then I'm better off anyway because I know where I'm going." Leak, age 39, said the issue has troubled many local pastors. "A lot of them say I'm damned if I do, damned if I don't," he said. "If you had a mask mandate, you'd have people leave your church. By the same token, you'd have some people leaving if you don't mandate masks." "It's hard being a minister these days," he said. "Some weeks I don't know a single pastor who wants to be pastoring right now." Leak became Calvary's pastor in April 2019. Within a year, he found himself ministering to congregants beleaguered by coronavirus-related woes. The pandemic's disruption strained some marriages. Leak offered counseling but said two or three couples broke up. He helped organize delivery of care packages to shut-ins who couldn't leave home. Through it all, he's remained adamant. There is value in coming together in body and spirit. He wrote an impassioned note to the congregation in July explaining why he would attend in person even if he weren't the pastor. "There is something which the generations preceding me understood that I believe has been lost upon my generation," he wrote, "and that is the power of showing up. There is something powerful about you being there." We've run out of time for this week's edition of Religion in the News. We certainly do hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service. This broadcast is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Don't forget that podcasts of this and other Religion in the News broadcasts are available on our website, ncreadingservice.org. Just click on the Listen tab and then select the podcast section. We hope you have a wonderful week and a very happy new year to you. We'll talk to you next time. I'm Brian LeBlanc. This has been Religion in the News from the North Carolina Reading Service.